Does the enterprise need a kickstart? Undecisilian is a funny word, and we bow to our future Internet of Things overlords. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for the following show is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, Episode 11, recorded September 24th, 2012, The Internet of Bouncing Things. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. It just takes a webcam and a click to turn your online meeting into high-definition video conferencing. Meet with colleagues anywhere in the world, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit gotomeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by MailRoute. MailRoute is email filtering in the cloud for companies of any size. If you're tired of little or no support from your email filtering service, then MailRoute is the answer for you. For 10% off the life of your account, visit MailRoute.net, click the sign up button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twiet This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by a fantastic panel, starting with our in-studio guest, Mr. Hugo Fiennes from Electric Imp. Hugo, very good to for you to come in.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you want to tell us a little bit about who you are and who you represent?
Okay, I'm Hugo Fiennes, as you already said. I'm the founder of Electric Imp. We make a device which, and a service which connects anything to the internet. As a geek, I got bored with waiting for the Internet of Things to arrive, so.
So you decided to make it.
I decided to do something about that.
Yeah. Right. And actually, you have some experience with designing interesting electronic devices. Can you mention what your previous gig was?
My previous gig was I was a hardware manager at Apple on the iPhone for the first four phones. And then I did lots of MP3 players before that, and the first in-car MP3 player about 13 years ago, maybe now.
A long time. Yeah, so you know a little bit about design.
I've made a few things.
Okay. Now,
most of them still work.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Actually, most of them are up on our museum in the back there, so you can check them out after the show.
Cool.
Now, he's not the only one we have. We're joined, as always, by Mr. Brian Chi from the Advanced Networking Computer Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii, the evangelist for ThingLinks. Brian, what's going on in Honolulu?
I am just finishing my packing. I'm getting ready to hop on a plane to New York for Interop.
You want to explain a little bit about what that's going to be?
Big, lots of toys, take over the Jacob Javits Center, lots of geeks getting together, putting together some of the latest and greatest, best toys on the face of the earth for the enterprise geek.
Good. Okay. Well, I'll be there right alongside you playing with some of the coolest toys in enterprise technology. Speaking of enterprise technology, we're joined by Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency on the other side of the country. Curtis, how are things out in Florida?
Well, we're having our first little taste of fall. The high is only about 86 degrees today, and the humidity is probably down in the 40s somewhere. So for us, it's a cool, crisp day. And it's a great day to be talking about the Internet of Things. Takes me back a little bit. You know, before we met, I was chief editor for Circuit Seller Inc., worked with Steve Ciarcia back putting lots of things on the Internet around the time you could put stuff on the Internet if you weren't a government or research institution.
So you've got a little bit of expertise here. As always, we've got a lot of expertise on this panel. That's what we're all about. And right now, we want to take that expertise into our Enterprise Bite of the day.
this time we're talking about IOSafe. Now, you may remember IOSafe from a BYB, a Before You Buy episode a few weeks back. They make some incredibly durable hard drive enclosures, hard drive products. We've crushed them. We've thrown them in the pools. We've shot them. We've baked them. We've basically tried to do everything we could to destroy them. And, well, they came back smiling each and every single time. We have been watching IOSafe because they make a really interesting product. It's a combination of really good design for the hardware and this amazing data recovery service, sort of an insurance for your data. Well, they've taken that philosophy and they've gone one step further by asking for a kickstart. That's right. They've used Indiegogo to fund their upcoming product. They want to take something like this. This is one of their IOSafe boat anchor products. This is rated to survive, you know, that tractor crush or the 30 minutes in a crazy house fire. These things are pretty much indestructible, and they want to make a NAS. Well, rather than trying to fund it all themselves, they've opened up an Indiegogo page, which allows people to pretty much pre-buy units or pre-buy access to units, which will offset some of the cost of actually developing the device. Now, I know IOSafe, and I know they're going to be around, and I know that they're actually going to deliver on their promises, but this brings up the question of, is the Kickstarter model, is the Indiegogo model, is the alternate funding mechanism model being corrupted by established companies now taking advantage of something that was created for, well, bootstrappers and startups? Hugo, you've got experience with this. Tell me what you think.
Actually, there's something to be said for companies doing it. It kind of proves the market for them. It's like, I think a lot of the problem that startups have who don't have a product and they're creating something from scratch is that what they do is that they suddenly end up with a lot of customers. People kind of think it's like, oh, they get funding. And it's like, no, they have orders. Orders need fulfillment. It's not just developing the product. You've got to develop it and then roll it out to lots of people. It almost actually works better, I think, for some ones when they're established companies because you know they're going to deliver.
Right.
So it's actually just, okay, we could make this. Would you like us to? But it's very hard to ask that in a normal commercial setting.
Right, right. And actually, Indiegogo was specifically designed for something like this. You know, it's not just a Kickstarter. It's sort of a level up. But Brian, you've talked a little bit about the Kickstarter model. What do you think about this model of paying for tech, paying for products while they're still vaporware?
You know, I don't know. I've actually really gotten crazy with Kickstarter. I think I'm in like six or seven now. And I like the concept. What I really like for established corporations is that you're getting money in, you're getting pre-orders, and you're not paying interest on it. That's the real problem with VC. You know, unless you have an angel investor, your VC is going to cost you an awful lot of money to borrow that money. And you're going to start your corporation owing a lot of people. So Kickstarter does make a lot of sense, especially for smaller products.
All right, smaller products, smaller companies. But Curtis, what happens when you start crossing that threshold from a company like IOSafe, which, yes, is still on the smaller side. They still have a niche product. But, you know, they've been established. They've been around. They're an actual player in the market. And they're using a funding mechanism that was designed for no-namers. Is there a conflict there?
Well, I think there are two potential issues, one more serious than the other. The less serious issue, if you will, at least from a lot of perspectives, is the one of trust. I mean, this is a mechanism that, as you said, was designed for startups. And so there has been to this point that sort of implicit promise that you were dealing with a startup, a company that didn't have the means to fund a product or fund a product development process through more traditional means. If a company represents itself as one of these startups but isn't, then that's a significant problem. And I think companies like IOSafe and others that are more traditional companies and larger, have access to greater funds, need to be very, very clear with the people who are funding them through Kickstarter that they are what they are. Now, the second issue is more serious because that gets to the point that really they're talking about a finite pool of funds. And if an established company, a company that does have alternatives, starts soaking up some of this pool, well, then it naturally means less of a pool available for those startup companies that have a critical need for this. I worry more about that. The trust issue is one that the market ultimately will sort out one way or the other. The availability of funds is something that really people need to think about. And that includes people at companies that do have alternative mechanisms for funding. They should be good corporate citizens and not abuse a system that's helping the startups.
Now, that's actually a very interesting take, because I think most people, when they think of Kickstarter, they think of, oh, there's an upcoming storm of frauds when all these Kickstarters fail. Now, Hugo, you've been on both sides of the coin. You've bootstrapped a company much in the same way as a Kickstarter, and you've gone the VC route, where you've actually had a product, gathered a team, and then pitched it. Where do you think this falls in that spectrum?
It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's just advanced market research. It's almost like, you know, it is always, as a small company, it's hard to pick where you're going to put your resources, how you're going to actually, you know, there are always a multitude of choices. You know, you could build 10 different products. Which one are you going to pick? And this is sort of like hedging your bets. It's like, well, this one maybe. So, you know, maybe they've got an internal development for some other IOSafe products, which they're really sure are going to sell. And this is one of the maybe ones, and they're just trying it out to see. I mean, it's kind of like it seems to be a risk avoidance scheme.
which is not bad. Risk avoidance, if you can do it, that is a great method to use to get a product to market.
It is, but I think it does seem like, I haven't actually looked much into this product myself, but a NASBox is a fairly big commitment for a design if they're doing everything from scratch.
Right.
More complexity than their existing products.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what enlightens me is I know their products, and I know their products work. I mean, they've got really cool tech behind it that basically keeps the drive safe in a fire, in a flood, in a crush situation. And the NASBox is basically just a growth from this. Mm-hmm. You're taking the same technology and you're encasing it within their ceramic. Their what is it, H2O infused ceramic that creates a positive pressure in a fire. They got some really cool demonstrations that they've done over the year. So, you know, throw it back to Brian and to Curtis here. When you look at a company like IOSafe, and they are going to deliver this, and this N2, this network-attached storage disaster-proof box, is going to be pretty cool. What do you think, Brian, about being a responsible corporate citizen and not taking cash from, you know, lesser entities?
I don't know. I really agree with Hugo on it's a risk avoidance mechanism. You know, I'm in a quandary. I do agree with Curtis that, you know, gee, the little guys, the ones that are just trying to get started, you know, I'm in for the Nomiku sous vide cooker. And that was a huge risk for a bunch of cooks that wanted to have a cheaper sous vide or better sous vide cooker. But for the established corporations, you know, I don't know. You know, it's a nice way to stretch your funds. It's a nice way to avoid some risk on a product that may never have seen the light of day. And who knows, maybe as far as the IOSafe people are going, they are seeing an awful lot of competition in the NAS market. You know, I've been doing reviews on them for the past year and a half, and there's an awful lot of them. So this might be a way to bring a product to market that may not have seen the light of day under other circumstances.
Yeah, and in that sense, I actually kind of like this. I think it's a bold move. Maybe it kind of stretches the boundaries of who should be using this sort of startup capital mechanism. But from my previous experiences with the product, I'm glad that a product that may not have seen the light of day is making it into the light of day. Mm-hmm. Last words?
Yeah, I mean, there's an interesting question. If they don't make their Indiegogo funding goal, will they make it anyway because they can see there's demand?
Good question. I mean, and again, it's free marketing research. If they see enough of demand and they don't get enough of the top tier donations, then you know, maybe they'll just say, well, we know that people will buy it at this price point, so let's make it anyways.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, well, let's move on, because we've got another stuff my IT guy says. This time we're talking about the sky falling, and it's not the sky, it's IPv6.
here at the Hot Stage Warehouse in Brisbane, California, getting ready for Interop 2012. Next to me is Jeff Enters, who is the worldwide IPv6 portfolio manager.
Very good.
Okay, got it. Now, IPv6, it's something that we've heard of, but many of us have sort of discounted. I mean, it was sort of the sky is falling prediction for the longest time. In fact, IPv6 has been around for how many years?
10 plus years.
10 plus years, and only now are, well, the predictions finally coming true. I believe last year we actually ran out of addressing space.
That is correct, yep. IANA, who's the overall authoritative for handing out addresses, handed it out to the last of those addresses to the regional internet registries, the RIRs, and so we have definitely officially ran out at this point. I think the key for people to understand right now is the IPv6 internet, if you will, is out there, and there's an IPv4 internet, and there's no connectivity between those two. So there's a lot of things that people need to start thinking about as far as maybe competitive advantage of being on that IPv6 internet before your customer, and things along that line. So it's really the time to start looking at that IPv6 internet and see if there's opportunity there.
Now, in the IPv4 addressing scheme, it was that familiar 4-octet string of numbers.
Correct.
That determined what address your computer had. Mm-hmm. Now, how many combinations were there in that? I forget.
About 4.2 billion.
Yeah, which is a lot, but we've run out of them. And how many combinations are in IPv6?
If I remember correctly, I think it's about 340 undecillion. Times to get a little stuff.
Someone once told me that you could give an IP address to every grain of sand on the planet Earth and still have addresses left over.
That is absolutely correct, Plenty of room left. Yeah. So.
And this addressing space, the original intent behind IPv4, and of course the intent behind IPv6, was this idea of pervasive connectivity.
Yes.
Everything should be connected. Everything should be addressable, and IPv6 will finally allow that, right?
That is correct, yeah. That is really breaking down right now with everybody with the home routers doing that. Even the carriers doing carrier-grade NAT now, which is absolutely a challenge. And then you got things like NAT 444, which is actually doing NAT multiple times. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about breaking things, that's where it happens. So you get things like if a carrier needs to shut down somebody, they're going to shut it down at that public IP address. They're not going to know how many private IP addresses are behind there. So it really becomes a challenge from a security and login standpoint, too.
Okay, Mr. Portfolio Manager, let's get down to brass tacks here. There are a lot of people out there who are saying this is still just a doom and gloom prediction. This is still just the sky is falling, but in fact, they're happy with IPv4. They've been using it forever. They are coming up with these super strange workarounds with NAT.
Sure.
So why should they switch? If I have a small to medium business and everything seems to be working, I've got enough addresses for my devices, why should I even consider putting the time and the expense into enabling IPv6?
One word, inevitability. How's that one?
Yeah.
IPv6 internet, if you will, is inevitable. IPv6 is inevitable. It's coming. It's going to be here. There's no other way around it. So you either start to plan now, because this is not a one-year transition plan. This is not a two-year overall transition. This is a 5 to 10 year transition that's going to happen. You're going to run dual stack for a long period of time. It's possible you may have pockets of IPv4 within your IPv6 network many, many years down the road. So starting to plan now for something that is inevitable seems like the right thing to do.
So
it seems pretty logical.
Grow now or die later.
Yeah. The hard part for companies is going to be, you know, banks is a really good example. There's places in China that are only allowing IPv6 internet or giving it out for free kind of things. And so when that's happening, if I can only connect to bank A via IPv6 and bank B doesn't have IPv6, who am I going to go to for business?
Right.
University of Hawaii is another great example in which if you're on their IPv6 network and you have an IPv6 address, you actually have a much faster pipe to the internet than you do with IPv4, because they do their peering happens local on the island for IPv4 versus in the States for IPv6. So they actually get better bandwidth, better speeds. Same thing for peering. A number of peering applications out there right now that are using IPv6 because they can get around some of the bandwidth limitations that can be put on from some of the carriers. So lots of opportunity out there with IPv6.
Now, HP has been working with IPv6 forever, and you've been dual stacking it, and you've been enabling customers to sort of turn it on at their leisure. But if they want to find out more information, if they want to actually talk to you and find out what kind of services HP can provide for IPv6, where should they go?
They should take a look right about here, or stop by the InteropNet NOC booth at Las Vegas and ask for Jeff Enters. That's me, and I'll be more than happy to talk more about it and give you a nice little backstage tour of the NOC.
And buy a beer and maybe a steak dinner?
Maybe one of those.
Maybe, okay. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you, Father Robert.
We'll see you at the show, and hopefully you'll be doing all sorts of IPv6 goodness, because the show does run IPv6 and IPv4. And you stay tuned, because we've got more from Interop 2012.
This portion of TWiET was sponsored by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix. Now, I could tell you all the reasons why you should have GoToMeeting with HD Faces. I could tell you that it's the easiest way to set up a meeting. I could tell you that it gives you HD video. I could tell you that you can share documents and collaborate and share your desktop with one another. I could tell you that all you need is to be able to click, to send an email, or to set up a calendar date to set up a high-definition, full collaboration online meeting. But here's the thing. It's not about what GoToMeeting can do for you. It's about how you can use GoToMeeting to do what you do better. That's right. Just this week, I used GoToMeeting when I had a conference call with a Jesuit on the East Coast. We were hashing out some details for a project we're doing next year in Brazil. And, our telephone call went from a very simple conversation to something far more complicated. We started adding in slides, emailing them back and forth, and then two or three other Jesuits wanted to jump into the phone call, and before we knew it, it became really confusing. Well, without a second thought, I was able to start up GoToMeeting. I was able to jump in and schedule a meeting just by clicking a few buttons on my desktop, and we were all invited. We were all able to see one another. We were all able to share our desktops, to see the plans, to see the documents, to see the pictures that we were emailing back and forth. It turned what could have been a confusing phone call into a fabulously productive GoToMeeting. Now, this is what I want you to do. I want you to see how easy GoToMeeting with HD Faces is. My listeners can try it free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Be sure to use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting. Meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Brian, you've done a lot of work with IPv6 because you work at a university. So naturally, an educational and academic environment is going to play with that protocol before anybody else. What bumps have you seen on the roadmap to implementation?
The number one bump has actually been, how the heck do you get to the DNS? So for the most part, a lot of people run dual stack. So you get your DNS with IPv4, and then in your IPv4 DNS, you have quad A records so that you know how to get to the IPv6 stuff. But there's a problem. And that other problem is DHCP. There's a giant argument going on. To DHCP or not to DHCP, that is the question. And the answer basically is not clear yet. So the folks running VoIP, they need to be able to go and give options so they know how to get to the call manager or whatever you call it. You need to be able to go and feed lots of different option information from DHCP into different types of devices, and there is no such thing as DHCP and IPv6 right at this moment. There are experimental versions out there from places like Microsoft, Infoblox, and so forth, but there isn't a standard yet. Everybody's complaining, everybody's fighting. The likely answer is it's going to be a little bit of lightweight DHCP just to handle options, and the rest of the configs are probably going to be through the IPv6 router config that seems to be very popular. The chat room's talking a lot about peering and things like that. IPv6 also has a lot of real interesting peering issues, and that looks like a very good topic for a future episode. But IPv6, it's the little nitty-gritty things. The endpoints have v6, even HP printers and so forth. But it's how you get it all configured. That's the nitty-gritty problem that a lot of people don't seem to realize, and the standards groups really need to concentrate on.
Now, Curtis, you deal a lot with, getting news out to the enterprises. This has been a little bit of a the sky is falling story for the past decade, has it not?
Yeah, it seems like a sky is falling story forever. And I tell you what I think is an interesting aspect of this. There's an extent to which one group of engineers has done almost too good a job. Brian mentioned the people who are running dual stacks, IPv4 and IPv6, with a translation mechanism between them. There's an extent to which that has been too good. Because while we're hearing all of the sky is falling about running out of addresses, companies believe that they're going to be able to continue running IPv4 for the foreseeable future. And that's taken all the urgency out of it for many, many companies, especially in, say, North America and Europe. The fact that we don't have answers for things like DNS. We don't have conclusive answers for things like DHCP. If we knew that we were absolutely positively going to have to go to IPv6 in 6 months, I think there'd be a lot more urgency in getting a response for these problems. Instead, we're leaning on dual stacking. And when you talk to people in some of the big enterprises, they're assuming that they're just going to be able to dual stack and keep everything on the inside running IPv4 for the rest of their career.
I want to throw this over to Hugo. Without going too much into what we're going to be talking about during the case study, your work requires IPv6. The Internet of Things requires a lot of addresses, right?
Yeah, I mean, although actually the way we've done it, we've done the Electric Inn product works on IPv4 at the moment. It will do IPv6. It's capable of that, and we will be upgrading it to that. But because most of our customers are kind of home and small people, the way it works is we just go straight through firewalls and that, and every device connects to our server, and that's kind of like the routing mechanism. We have multiple servers which talk to the devices. It's kind of a pragmatic solution because it actually works now and we can ship it now and requires no configuration. And that's pretty much the most important thing for our customers at the moment.
Cheever, what do you think about that? I mean, if Electric Imp can take their Internet of Things and put it on IPv4, and if, you know, this is still a sky is falling situation, then what is this competitive advantage that every IPv6 proponent I know of is always talking about? That, well, you're either going to do it now or you're going to do it later. If the Internet of Things will run on IPv4, then do we actually need to move to IPv6?
Well, you know, V6 has just got to happen. You know, we just don't have enough address space in V4. There's a lot of problems with NAT. NAT works great. I use NAT. I have an inside and an outside, and my inside is all NATed. But having directly addressable address space is really important. Maybe not as much for Hugo, but for the cell phone manufacturers. A lot of the cell phone networks are V6. Almost all of Japan, NTT in Japan, Tokyo, there is no V4 on their backbone. They do 6-4 in the router, home routers. But more and more, they're dropping that. And if you're running newer operating systems like Mac OS X or Windows 7 or Windows 8, you don't need to run V4 at all in the home. Everything self-discovers using V6. And I think that's actually a really good thing. Now, as far as devices go, there's going to be an awful lot of devices, especially when we start getting into smart homes, getting into the Zigbee electric meters and things like that. That's an awful lot of address space, and it just wouldn't really be responsible to keep staying on V4.
Curtis, I want to give you the final word here on IPv6. Will companies that adopt IPv6 actually get a competitive advantage? You know, I actually fall with Chibert on this. We're going to have to move to V6 at some point. But is there an advantage to doing it now rather than doing it, say, 2-3 years down the line when we absolutely can no longer put devices in IPv4?
Well, I think that the advantage to doing it now is probably one of vendor and integrator access. Right now, if you want to do it, you'll still be considered something of an early adopter. And so you can get the attention of the engineering staff from your hardware vendor, from or various software vendors, and even from your service providers. If you wait until everyone is having to do it, then you're going to be just one in a long queue of companies and people trying to make it happen before the sky actually falls. I'll admit I'm a little bit of a pessimist after hearing all of the dire predictions for the past decade. I think that the ISPs and the service providers of various sorts are going to do their best to allow their customers to pretend IPv6 doesn't exist for a long time to come. I think it really is going to be a very, very long time, probably until sometime after all of our careers are over, before there's a complete switch over from V4 to V6.
Well, with only 340 undecillion addresses, I'm thinking by the time my career ends, we're going to need to go to IPv8 so we can address every atom in the universe. That's just me. Now, IPv4 or IPv6, you know something that won't go away? That's spam. Now, does your company need maximum no spam? Do you spend a lot of your time dealing with email filtering, with getting rid of malware and with spamware? Do you have a provider who is, let's just say, less than responsive? If any of those things are true, then you need to try out MailRoute. That's right. MailRoute offers live support. They actually give you a human, a real-life person that you can contact Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 8 o'clock p.m. Pacific time. Need assistance after hours? Then when you call MailRoute, a service ticket is automatically generated, and you receive a callback within the hour. MailRoute is hosted email filtering in the cloud for businesses of any size. There's no easier way to filter your email. You don't need any hardware or software. You just point your email, your MX record, to MailRoute. They filter it, and then they deliver the clean email to your email server. Now, because MailRoute is in the cloud, it eliminates the need for having a dedicated server for spam filtering. All that's necessary to sign up with MailRoute is no credit card and a change to your DNS MX record, and you start the flow of clean email. Now, one of my favorite features is that if you are making a change to your Exchange server, to your email server, to whatever it is that you're hosting on your own, well, you don't have to worry about bounced emails because MailRoute will actually hold them until your server responds, and then it will forward it. So it's like having a backup to your email up in the cloud. Now, MailRoute is email done right. They have recently added an administrative interface that gives you direct control over every aspect of your service, from setting the sensitivity of the email filtering to adding domains of users and managing whitelists and blacklists so you can customize it and make it work the way that you want it to work. Now, over the last 12 months, we blocked over 235,000 spam messages for Tom Merritt's domain. That's 99.7% of his total mail volume. We also blocked nearly 600,000 messages for Leo in the last 12 months. That's over 12 million messages blocked by MailRoute for Leo since he started using the service. Now, MailRoute also has disastrous recovery service that's included with your subscription. It holds mail and for up to 15 days, so if it ever goes down, well, you're covered. Now, I want you to try it free. Visit MailRoute.net. Click the sign up button and enter the promo code ENTERPRISE to start your 15-day free trial and get 10% off for the life of your account. There's no credit card required for the free trial. That's MailRoute.net. Click the sign up button and enter the promo code ENTERPRISE. We thank MailRoute for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to the meat of things. We are talking about the Internet of Things. Hugo, what is the Internet of Things?
Pretty much it's things connected to the Internet. I mean, you know, it's been talked about a lot, and it sort of goes everywhere from infrastructure to buildings to home automation type things. And I think there's a lot more areas that we're going to see the Internet of Things be applied to as technology like becomes more pervasive and it goes lower and lower down into I guess, the classes of electronic device. As it gets cheaper and more accessible, it's just going to go everywhere. Everything will be able to talk to you.
Now, right now on screen is a graphic from Cisco talking about their vision of the Internet of Things. And it's a really cool representation of how these devices have exploded in just a few years. We've gone from a couple of million devices to, you know, by 2020, they're estimating 50 billion devices. And that includes everything from phones to mobile devices to laptops to what we would consider computers, all the way down to sensors. So you could put, say, in this instance, cattle tags onto the internet. So you could ping cattle, find out how they're doing, find out the data that will let you know how they're producing. And, you know, that's a silly example, but there's this idea of putting an internet of things that are just sensors. And there's several companies doing that right now so that we get more and more data. And I like how this works, because when we look at the progression of the internet, we went from static pages to sort of dynamically generated pages, to pages that leverage the information that we've collected, to now we want to actually put more devices out into the internet to gather more data to see what we can do with that data. Chibert, where do you see the applications for this? I mean, as we move to the Internet of Things, as we move to this global network of sensors and devices that just give us more data, how does that get used?
I was in a DARPA-funded project back about 10 years ago called PODS. It was part of a Sensit project. The whole concept was, if you can provide a greater density of sensors, then you can start doing some really interesting things. So, like, for instance, in the world of weather prediction, if, say, for instance, just about every household had a weather station that was internet addressable and could be queried, say, by the National Weather Service, now all of a sudden you've got a high enough density that you can actually predict airflow over the continental United States, which could do some really interesting things for tornado prediction, drought, all kinds of really cool things. So once you start getting into the Internet of Things, you start having this information explosion, but you're going to have to start using that information more intelligently and be able to digest it and start working on models so you don't get deluged by, say, tweets. What you want is you want to have just the tweets where the weather has changed. And if you start boiling things down like that, you start getting more usable information. So that's my warning to people doing Internet of Things. Don't just tweet intelligent.
Now, Curtis, actually, that's an interesting point, because when we first started seeing sensors, dumb sensors put up on the internet, that's what they were used for. They were used to find out if the refrigerator was open, or if someone was, you know, on the toilet, or if a door had been opened, which is interesting, but I don't need a tweet each and every single time that happens. How do we go from that, from just that blah of information that no one needs, to something that the enterprise would actually look forward to?
Well, I think that you have to be careful and not confuse the mechanism of providing information with the mechanism of delivering that information to wherever it's going to be consumed. Twitter is a ridiculously bulky way of getting information around. What I think we will probably see as we move forward and have more sensors are some proprietary protocols that are very efficient at moving just those tiny little bits of information from place to place. There are already some things out there coming out of ham radio, either packet radio, some of the cell data. Algorithms work very well for this, but it's not going to look anything like Twitter unless you have that rare case where an individual needs one piece of this information. The thing is, when you start applying some of the big data techniques, that's when things get interesting, to provide some sophisticated analysis where you can, for example, prevent something like, I'm old enough to remember the Love Canal scenario. What if we had sensors built into buildings where key chemical components could be detected? That way, if something begins to come up, it can be detected in small quantities in different locations that can be put together and analyzed, and people can start seeing trends. Now, the real question is, who are the trend watchers? Who do we trust to have that kind of information on what's going on around our house? I suspect that what we'll see are enterprises trading off data analysis for, oh, let's say advertising or marketing access. We've seen it before. I think we're going to see a lot more of this. And I suspect that at some point, individuals are going to need to become much more sophisticated in what they will allow a company to do and what they demand in return for providing this kind of access to their environment.
Speaking of access to the environment, Hugo, we've actually got a demonstration here of at least a small part of the Internet of Things. Now, because typically we'd be dealing with a flurry of sensors, it's hard to make that impact known and felt, but we've got that here. This is actually a prototype of a device that you created for our very own Liz here in the studio, because we want to know how many times she bounces, right?
Yeah.
And so tell me exactly what this is.
Okay, so Brandon back at Electric Headquarters came up with this. This is basically a pressure mat which is connected to the internet. So what it is, it's a couple of pieces of acrylic with some resistive sensors inside, and they're hooked up to an imp. And I know you can see a little blinking light, blinks green every now and again.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Just on the other side. So basically that is connected to the internet, connected to the Electric Imp back-end server, and it's monitoring locally the resistance of these strips. And if it senses pressure, it sends a message. And that message is piped to a couple of places. One is, just for the purposes of this demo, we have this light over here, which is plugged into a little power control thing. And if I tap this... Now, that's actually, it's not locally, that's going up. Both of them are connected independently via secure channels to our server, which is up in Amazon EC2. And when I press that, you know, it's a secure packet going up saying, hey, something's happened, and it's being translated back down to turning that light on for half a second. But it's also being sent to COSM, which COSM is logging it, so I have little graphs. So when there is actually a big bouncy ball on top of this and someone bouncing up and down, every bounce will be sent up to COSM, and you can actually get a graph over time. And I think I dropped the URL in the chat thing. But basically, it's as there's no one bouncing on it, it's not very interesting at this moment. But but basically, it's you know, you can, it just kind of shows how easy it is to hook anything up. And inside here, there's nothing. There's an imp and four AA cells, and it's hooked directly up to these resistive strips. But basically, it's just intended to do to make this.
Can we trigger that a few more times? Let's see if we can get that up to.
It doesn't update. You have to refresh it. COSM doesn't refresh.
Oh yeah, there we go.
So you can get an idea of the rate of bouncing. So excitement level of the day, possibly. You could have bounces per hour as well. But it's just a demo of how easy it is to hook stuff up. And I mean, a lot of the times, the Internet of Things is not about, you know, some earth-shattering information. It's about, you know, it's knowing just one bit of information in a timely fashion, or how something is trending, or whatever, and collecting this information has been really hard, especially to make a new product to do it. And kind of what we did is put all the networking technology and some processing and so on into a really cheap, easy-to-use card. And then let people, you know, do what they want with it, including this type of thing.
Right. I mean, see, that's what excites me most about the Internet of Things, because there are natural enterprise applications, but it's going to start with someone who picks up an Electric Imp card,
yep,
who starts hacking with it and creates an application like this. Now, again, this is sort of a silly application. This is something that we did just to show that it works, just to show proof of concept. But it really does show how you can take a single-use device, how you can take a low-powered device and get data out of the real world, and then take that data and split it up any way you want. In this case, that data is being used to light up these lights every time someone bounces, but also to upgrade a graph. Now, imagine a whole swarm of those sensors being put around the brick house to measure any type of stimulus, any type of input. And you see where these come in handy. Now, Chibert, where would you see technology like this getting hacked and then making its way into the enterprise?
Well, actually, I used the mat not too different from that for sticking under a door. And, you know, that was how I triggered the squeaky door effect in a haunted house that I did many, many years ago. But in the enterprise, little sensors, we've been taking a good hard look at putting those into things like air ducts so we can measure the airflow. Balancing the air conditioning in a building is an amazingly complex and tedious process. But if you have more information, maybe the air conditioning will even out and can save a lot of energy. We could do things like better occupancy sensors. We can do things like better fire sensors, better smoke sensors. It's all about data density. Getting higher data density means maybe I use better airflow management in my data centers. Maybe I might shift the servers around because I've got hotspots. It's all about data density.
Okay, well, Curtis, looking at data density and looking at increasing the data density, getting all these little input points, what is your vision for letting hackers, letting inventors take this kind of device and start extracting data from the real world?
Well, I think we have a couple of models that have worked pretty well on that. One of them certainly would be Netflix. You know, Netflix has run a couple of competitions for hackers, basically saying, can you do our job better than we do? They offered some cash prizes, but when you talk to the Netflix people, the real reason they did this was to try and attract talent. I think companies will start to do that. Can you take this data density and make something useful out of it? The other great model are actually some of the Google mashups. When you can take Google applications, build some data analysis out of them, you can do some wonderful things. So I think what we're going to see are more and more cases of companies offering to allow hackers access to grids of anonymized data so that they can build some really sweet applications that can then be commercialized or even put out via some sort of open software foundation license and put to some pretty slick uses. I think the possibilities are really good.
Hugo, I want to give you the last word on this. I know that I believe the electric imp devices were used at SF Disrupt this year, and the top two devices did use your interface, did use your gear.
Definitely, I didn't manage to get tickets, but I know the winner of the hackathon was Lifebolt, and they used basically an imp dev kit. They had a web backend and a real piece of hardware to hook it up to a servo connected to a door lock. It can go in so many different places. We're working with lots of different people. Some of the things are kind of fanciful. Some of them are really useful. I mean, some of the things like, finding free meeting rooms in a large company by having distributed motion sensors, that type of thing is a very, very simple application. Elder monitoring, which is a home application, just loads of things where you just want to, often you're doing big data type analysis in the cloud, and the company doing this, it's kind of like the big data analysis is their thing, but they just need to be able to see what the real world, sense the real world, and we're kind of being the simple way to do that.
What I like about this is you really are a disruptive technology. I mean, you really could change not just how we look at our own devices, but how enterprise uses data and how enterprise collects data to do what they need to do, no matter what type of enterprise they're running.
Yeah, and I think efficiency and there's a lot you can do. Google have proven there's a lot you can do by monitoring data and trying to pull trends and so on out of it. It's a field in its infancy, especially for real world data. But it's going to be interesting the next 5-10 years.
Thank you very much. Now that's pretty much all the time we've got for this episode. But before we go, I did want to give a shout out to one of our advertisers, Audible.com. Now, Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks. They've got over 100,000 titles from fiction to nonfiction, drama, comedy, documentaries. Pretty much everything you want to listen to, everything you want to read, you can find at Audible.com. Now, for listeners of Twiet, Audible is offering a free audiobook. That's a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. What I would suggest is you use that free book to download Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card. Now, anyone who's read sci-fi knows this book. It's sort of one of the staples in sci-fi for the last two decades. It's about a boy who, is gifted. He's gifted with a brilliant mind for strategy, for planning, And it evolves from that, from a standard sci-fi sort of fish out of water tale to something that has intergalactic consequences. I suggest you download this book and just give it a try. See if Audible is for you. I find that I'm always listening to audiobooks in the plane, in the car, when I'm walking to the office. It's become my preferred way to consume content, to consume literature, to consume the books that I otherwise wouldn't get to read. To download this audiobook for free, or to download another one of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/enterprise. That's audiblepodcast.com/enterprise. We thank Audible for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, before we go, I want to give our fantastic guests a chance to plug whatever it is that they want to plug. Curtis, let's start with you. What's going on at Enterprise Efficiency?
I'm going to be working on a number of feature reports this fall, as well as a lot of audio and video programs. So I've got a request for the TWiET audience. If you are a CIO or a senior IT exec and wouldn't mind talking with me, give me a shout. My email is franklin@enterpriseefficiency.com, or you can send me a direct message at my tweet handle, which is right down there. Would love to talk with you, get a lot of great stuff coming up, and would love to have the voice of the TWiET crowd in there.
I can vouch for that, having participated in some of the great conversations on enterprise efficiency. I know that you have great topics, you've got a great moderator, and just a really nice laid-back format to talk about tech. Chibert, what about you? What's going on in Honolulu or with ThinLinks?
We are getting ready to build yet another video wall. This is starting to become a broken record. the folks at Matrox have been putting together some really, really interesting cards. If anyone's even contemplating doing a video wall or a large display, the Mira series is absolutely amazing. And the cool thing is, it's literally you can control it just by telnetting to the appliance. And the card itself, a 4 input, 4 output, is $5,000 street price, which is pretty amazing, considering that's doing the same job as a dedicated appliance, which put me back $45,000. So I don't think I'm going to be buying appliances anymore. I think we're going to be building them. And go Matrox.
Go Matrox. And you know what actually would go really well with those appliances? A few electric modules.
You bet.
Okay. Now, Hugo, you got a lot going on. I mean, your company just exited stealth mode and made a big splash both at Disrupt and at DEF CON. Tell me, what do you want our audience to know about you or Electric Hemp?
I guess the main thing I want the audience to know is we're hiring.
That's right.
Being a small startup, that's one of our most important things. ElectricHemp.com, there's a jobs page. But generally, the Electric Hemp card, and here's one people are asking what it looks like. It looks like a memory card. It's available now from sparkfun.com. So hobbyists, tinkerers, makers want to try it out, any vendors who are interested in, give us an email. And you know, we're very interested in enabling the next generation of connected devices.
That's right. And I have to point out, cool girl in the chat room she is willing to talk to anyone who has ideas for Electric Imp, especially people who would like to work for Electric Imp. I have to give that shout out, because otherwise she will hurt me when I go home. Again, that's all the time we've got. Before we go, I do want to say that if you are listening or watching this podcast on a download, why not watch us live? We're much more fun live. If you go to twit.tv/TWiET, you'll be able to find all the ways you can download our program. But if you visit us Mondays at noon, you'll be able to watch us live and participate in the live chat room at irc.twit.tv. That's because TWiT is not just a network. We're really a community. And if you join us when we're taping live, you get to be part of it. Also, please follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll be able to find out what we're covering on each episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech and suggest topics for future episodes. So all those people who have been emailing me, asking me how they give me comments, that's how you do it. Also, I want to thank everyone here at the Brick House, from my super producer Karsten to the super TD Jason, for making this all possible. This is a geek's paradise, and they just make it that much cooler. I'm Father Robert. This is the Brick House. And remember, If you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.